Today I am very excited because I am joined by someone I have met on social media, right? I've seen you grow, I've seen you do your content around personal finance, and for me what has stuck out was how consistent you have been in your message and in your actions. Thank you so much for joining me, S. It is incredible to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel like I'm having a starstruck moment. So I'm very excited to be here and to finally meet you.
Yeah, no, it is incredible. I mean, I've been following your personal finance journey, and as a creator in that space from when you started, I think I saw your stuff on Twitter. Then now you write, is it for Financial Mail, is it? Which is pretty incredible. How did you get to this point? Because maybe let's take it back, right? Give us a bit of background into who you are and what did you study and how you came to be a personal finance content creator.
Now, a great question, right? I always like to take it back, like you've said. So I always start off by saying I'm a mother of two.
Yeah.
I love my kids. That's something that I love defining myself on, because it's such a precious time. It's such a precious thing for me. So I come from the East Rand. I'm an East Rand girl. I went to high school there. I studied microbiology and biotech at the university.
Microbiology and biotech?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know, back in the days on SABC 3, there was this CSI program and everyone would be in the labs, and I thought, hey, I'm going to study that. I want to be in the labs. I want to solve mysteries, murder cases. And I sort of studied that, but I never actually practiced it, because in my final year, things really got horribly wrong. I realized, listen, I don't want to be in the labs for the rest of my life. How can I pivot to something I like? And I enjoyed, you know, business, finance, commerce, the commercial industry as opposed to science. So I then pivoted and started working for a bank as a graduate.
But also for me, what I find fascinating about people who've studied a BSc is that you're quite analytical. And most of the time in the financial services industry, you have to be analytical.
Absolutely. So I think one thing science always teaches you is to be analytical, to prove theories, right? Because you always have these theories, but actually, can we prove a theory? Is it true or not?
Yeah.
And I think that's where the analytical comes from, because you're always being taught to prove something. Does it stand? If A says A, does it actually equal to A? So there's a lot of us who love to look at things beyond the surface, things beyond what they look like at surface level. And I think I really enjoyed my time there. And I still use it till today in my in my day-to-day world, in the way I view things. I actually feel like that science degree was actually an advantage for me.
And I love what you're saying, because oftentimes now the rhetoric that is going around is, oh, going to university is a way, blah 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 blah, and it isn't. And you study something that is completely different, but you are able to apply in different spheres of your life, and one of those things being personal finance, right? That you started your own investment journey. But before we get to that part, give us a bit of background into S as a young child. Were your parents discussing money around the dinner table, as they call it, or around the household?
So my parents were in business, right? And one thing that you realize in business is money is not constant.
Yeah.
So there would really be peaks and troughs. So peaks, things would really be great. You would, you know, you'd see that money is flowing in, would eat well, would live well. And then there would be times when those troughs, when things were like, okay, you can see that things are starting to get a bit tough. And I think it was around that that shaped my view. And I see it almost coming out now in how I view money, is that there's almost this perception, there's, I want financial wellness. And I think that's where my personal finance, love for personal finance came in, to say, I want financial wellness. It doesn't always have to be peaks and troughs. It can be consistent if you plan for it, if you invest in your knowledge and do the things that ordinarily you should be doing, you will get to a point where you're financially well. So there'll be times when there'll definitely be lack, because life happens to all of us. But ultimately choose smooth over. It shouldn't be this peaks and troughs. It should smooth over. Mm. Almost, not a straight line per se, but almost this smooth way yeah. financially well.
So even when there is a bit of a trial, mm-hmm. you have, you know, positioned yourself in such a way that it does, it's not as bumpy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's it. You want to be, you know, have a buffer almost when the trough does hit.
Yeah.
You almost have a buffer that lifts you up to move you from that trough to almost this level exactly. playing field. And it's so important because I think we always think life will always be good. And as humans, we're optimistic, right? We always think this money that's coming in will always come in. And that's not always the case.
Yeah.
You get sick, a family member, something happens with a family member where you need to step in. We don't live in isolation. Mm. We live in a world, unfortunately, that's full of volatility and uncertainties to a certain extent. And what you're trying to do with some of the principles which I'll share is that you're trying to almost smooth that process.
Yeah. Mm. I like how you are saying, keep on saying financial wellness. Why do you choose that specific word?
Because, you know, not everyone wants... I always talk about financial freedom on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
Where ultimately what it means is that you've built yourself this world where you have investments, where your investments are able to take care of your monthly expenses and you just don't need your salary to survive on a monthly basis. And I've realized that's quite restrictive because not everyone will get to that place. I think we're all, personal finance is so personal. Each person has different circumstances that surround their finances. So it's almost, you want to be at a place where you're not worried about your finances. You're not worried about where the next food or your next meal is coming from.
Yeah.
You're not worried about how will I pay for my child's school fees? Mm-hmm. How will I help a loved one? Because I think all of us have loved ones that we would want to assist. How can I help my loved ones when they're lacking? So almost financial wellness says, around everything that you do, where you live,
it sounds more harmonious than just numbers and money, you know. And I love that definition. I love that definition. And I like the fact that you are aware, especially of our context in South Africa, just how difficult things are, you know. And I love the fact that, you know, for me, defining things and having a definition for things can be a point where people can relate with you.
Yeah.
And a point where people cannot relate with you.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, when it comes to personal finance, I think it's so important for people who are doing personal finance education that other people can see themselves, not only in them, but they see that, you know what, I can also change my situation regardless whether it is quite dire or whether, you know, I just haven't been, you know, consistent with my finances and doing well, but I can also get to financial wellness.
Absolutely. I think this, it's being practical, right? If you're in South Africa, and I always say people want to see themselves in a particular person.
Yeah.
And you always almost identify the certain things that you find in a person. Like for you, example, I identify with you because you represent a piece of me, right?
Yeah.
You represent me, a black female in the personal finance space. And what I found is that there weren't a lot of people that were looking like me that were talking about personal finance. And I wanted to almost say, but there's certain things that is so personal to me that I only a person who's walked this journey can identify with. And I'll give you an example, and I always share this, not in a bad way, but I think it's good for people to know. So I obviously went to the University of Cape Town, 4 years, my degree, because I did a double major, microbiology and biotechnology. It took 4 years. And in my final year, I remember going back in February, I went back and I was financially excluded. You know, my parents, you know, parents are optimistic, so they'll never tell you things, hey, listen, we're still trying to figure out a way for us to pay your school fees for this year. They'll just say, okay, go there.
You're going to school. We'll figure it out.
And I got there, and my first week I'm in res, because I was in res at the time, because I'm from the East and I'm in Cape Town. And I get there and I get a letter to say, no, you've been financially excluded. And that was something very real, because I was the first generation to go to the University of Cape Town and to be financially excluded, because during the holidays I would work as a cashier at a spa. And I got there, and it was either leave Cape Town, come back to, I always say Brakpan, because that's where I'm from.
Brakpan.
Brakpan, and be a cashier. And I knew how grueling it was, not to bring down anyone that's in the cashier thing, but it was during a holiday gig. And it was grueling, and you just get paid just to get by.
Yeah. But also knowing the fact that, you know what, I've studied for 4 years already. I've put so much time and effort and everything into this. That must have been heartbreaking.
It was very heartbreaking, and I think it was my first run-in with money.
Yeah.
And realizing what lack does. It basically excludes you, it disempowers you. It takes away this opportunity, because what money does, it gives you opportunities. Yeah. It gives you options. And the realization that, hey, I could actually be excluded from such an institution purely because of a lack of money made me feel disempowered. And I realized that not having money makes you feel disempowered. And I literally fought my hardest. I stayed with a friend. Luckily, there was a friend from high school who was staying in Cape Town. So I stayed with her while I was trying to figure out a plan. Luckily, they allowed me to register with just barely the minimum. And I literally found side gigs. I did promotions on Thursdays.
I like what you said. I fought hard. I didn't just pack my bags and say, oh, well, that's it. Because many, many, many people, and I mean, I think I've spoken even of my own things on this, struggles on this channel, to say when you are faced with a hard decision, yes, it's painful, it is as real as it gets, it's heartbreaking, but you always have a choice. Am I going to pack my bags and pack shop and say, you know what, there's nothing else I could do? I love that. And for me, I just wanted to also make people aware that, you know what, unfortunately, life is life. You are going to have to fight. You are going to have to fight.
Because the alternative is not that appealing.
Yeah.
It's either this or the alternative. And the alternative is usually worse than what it is. Like you said, 4 years of my life studying exams, you know, not sleeping, and all of a sudden to give up in my final year and go be back home was not an option for me. So I had to stay and dig deep and really stay through the year so that I could graduate.
And you did that through different gigs, staying with friends, the whole works.
Literally walk to campus. It means 20-30 minutes walking to campus, staying off campus. So the first semester I stayed off campus until finally in the second semester my parents made a plan and I was able then to go back into res. But during that time, Thursdays, we usually at UCT there's jammy stairs, so usually I'd be doing promotions on a Thursday. I would skip class. I'd bank class. It was the worst thing. I would catch up, but I would
because
do promotional.
You had to. You had to. You didn't have an alternative.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what were the conversations like between you and your parents? Because I mean, one time they couldn't afford to pay for your fees and you were excluded, and you know, they're making plans. What are the conversations at that point between you and them? And I mean, you're not home, you're not in Brakpan, you are in Cape Town and trying to figure things out.
So I think, you know, my parents are fighters, hustlers, so to speak, using the colloquial word, hustlers. They really, the breadwinners, they fought. So I knew when things were really tough that they'd given it their best. So I understood from my side, I think it was giving them the grace and realizing that they would never leave me in Cape Town to fend for myself if it wasn't the last resort. Because I know, listen, my mother loves me with everything. and I was assured of the love. And it was that love to say, you know what, they've brought me this far. I can do more. I'm a bit more independent. Yes, I'm in my fourth year, but I'm a bit more independent. I can actually try and assist them now because things must really be tough. And it was giving them that grace and realizing, because, you know, growing up, you think your parents are heroes. You have this hero complex of who they should
be. They are invincible. They are the perfect picture people, forgetting that they are actually people themselves.
Yeah, they've got inner children, battles that they also fight with. And I think it's realizing and giving them grace that they tried the best that they could. And I think when you realize that, you see them in a different light. And I've seen my parents in a different light, and I think we have a better relationship because of that.
And you know, I always find it so, just like, it feels like home talking to someone who has similar experiences with me, because one thing about my parents, they will go to the moon and back, right? And there's something about that that gives you a sense of self and confidence, even when things are tough, that I can achieve the end goal, isn't it?
So my mom always said, you know, you can do it. I know sometimes as kids growing up, we never understood it. But my mom was so, she put seed in all of us. I'm the eldest. I've got three other siblings. And one thing that when we converse, we realize is that my mother always believed in the best of us. And it was that belief that said, I can do better. Yeah. And you almost want to do better because you have this person that really is rooting for you and believes the best in you. So you have got no opportunity but just to show up.
Yeah.
Show up as much as you can to be the best
version. As this
person
that they say you are. You are. You know?
Absolutely.
You are. You know, I was in Durban a couple of weeks ago and I was talking to my dad over the phone because he also has done that for us. And there's something about talking to a very supportive parent that it just puts a fire under your feet that, yes, I know I was gunning for this, but now I want that because that person sees it in you.
Yeah.
So that is really incredible. And I think for me, I always try to also have these conversations outside of just personal finance that it is that support. Giving that to your kids, giving that to your siblings, giving that to the people that you love, that can just
propel them.
Propel them, exactly. Okay, now let's get back to your investment journey. How did you start? What was it, besides, of course, you know, that that point in your life when you're in university and you had to fend for yourself, basically? What was it that prompted you to get into personal finance, that really, I mean, you study something that is completely, completely different.
So funny enough, when I started working, I was very deliberate about, as a graduate, right? So during the graduate program in the bank, you would go through the various departments and you'd almost identify which department you wanted to be placed in. So after a 6-month rotation, they would put you, you would actually say where you wanted to be placed. And I was very deliberate. I wanted to be in business credit. And basically there I was dealing with financially distressed business clients and ultra high net worth individuals. And one thing you realize is that, you know, no one gets it right. No one knows what they're doing. So you would think people that are high net worth individuals would know how to manage their money. And I came in banking, obviously, and always I was working for a bank. And it's funny to say this, right? And I own it. 2 weeks before payday, I would be broke. And I was working for a bank. I was a young graduate. Here I was in the finance industry doing all of these things, but I was myself broke.
Yeah.
And it actually made me realize, let me take a step back, because obviously I'm assisting business clients that are financially distressed and high net worth individuals. And I almost saw a pattern. To say, okay, there's a pattern here, and if I want something different for myself, I'm going to have to really engage in personal finance. I'm going to have to do things differently. This cannot be my life. This cannot be where 2 weeks before payday, you're calling your friends to ask, you know, for petrol money to take you through the month.
Literally, paycheck to paycheck.
And I really hated it. And I realized I wanted something different for myself. I didn't want to be in this position anymore. I didn't want to be this disempowered. So I literally started reading up. I started listening to podcasts. I started reading Financial Mail. I started reading, you know, at the time, podcasts were not a lot. YouTube didn't have as much as what it does now. But I also started looking at who are the people that look like me in the space? Yeah. Who are the people that I can look up to? And literally, there's things about money that we don't know. All of us, I don't know about you, but when I started working, it was just, hey, I have this money, I'm getting this paycheck. But there was no orientation to say, listen, this is how you put a budget. Obviously, in my head, I had a budget.
It's okay. It's like a mental note, as I always put it.
Yeah, on a napkin somewhere.
Yeah, okay, like, money's going to go here. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
This is how it's going to be managed. But actually sitting down and saying, okay, what do I actually want for my money? What do I want in the next year or two? What does that look like? And it's basically putting a mindset shift, to say, okay, I actually want a certain thing for myself. And I literally had to work with what works well for me.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned, I'm a scientist by, you know, by tertiary education, but I realized that a spreadsheet works well for me.
Mm.
So I can actually account on an Excel spreadsheet. And I actually have a spreadsheet that dates back from 2012 that I still track till today.
Yeah.
So I always laugh at that to say I've been tracking my money since that long. It also part of the journey was also when at the time when I was working for the bank, we got an announcement at the time to say there will be retrenchments.
Mm.
And I remember seeing the panic on people's faces. Yeah. People had kids' school fees, people had cars, people had home loans to pay. And the idea that, listen, based on, I think it was on a Friday, we got the letter, I think on Monday or Wednesday, and on a Friday, if you got a letter, you were retrenched. Obviously, they were going to pay you 3 months.
Yes.
I think there was some mechanism around paying you out and stuff. But the realization that relying on one salary is dangerous.
Very dangerous.
Also a moment that was an aha moment for me to realize it's not as guaranteed as I think it is.
Mm.
There can actually be a point where I shouldn't solely rely on my salary just to sustain me. I should look at alternatives. So while I'm getting this paycheck, how can I use it to further my financial wellness, to further the buffer that I need to sustain myself if anything were to happen that I'm no longer able to work?
And okay, that happens. So I'm guessing, were you part of the people who stayed or part of the people who stayed?
Mm.
And that was a learning moment for you.
Mm.
I just want to figure out, how did you manage your finances? So you have this aha moment, right? Mm. And we all do, funny enough, we all do. But there seems to be a disconnect between our aha moments and us acting in the way we said, you know what, I do not want to ever experience something like this. For you, was it immediate where you said, you know what, I'm going to start or continue reading on personal finance and I'm going to make sure that I build up my emergency fund? Was there a disconnect, or you were able to immediately start saying, okay, how do I build my emergency fund?
It's gradual. Nothing happens abruptly.
Yeah.
And we're creatures of habit, right? I always go back to that. We're creatures of habit, and our habits give us comfort. So any change in our habit, we really don't want. So I've always managed money through, in my head, just before payday, this is where it's going. I have to pay this, I have to pay that, I have to pay that. And not accounting. So all of a sudden going to, listen, I need to take charge. So it was now, okay, now I need to do some sort of putting my money and knowing where it's going and looking at my bank statements. So back then, 2012, that's 2 years when my spreadsheet started. That's 2 year gap. But there've been moments that I've almost shifted and pivoted. So 2012, I started tracking, but then 2018, and I always say this, people that know me know this, that when I was listening to Bruce
Whitfield
on 702, he was interviewing this lady, Super Saver Julia, and I always refer to her. Because that was the sort of further aha moment, because I was like, no, wait a minute, this woman's been consistent. She's been able to put money away and get to the stage. So it was, okay, let me at least know how my money is doing. Let me pay off certain things. And I always say this, you know, there was a time when I swiped my credit card for clothes at YDE. Yeah. And
And that's majority later, of people. That's the majority of people.
A year later, these clothes don't fit me no more. And I'd spent this.
Perhaps you don't even like them that much anymore, right? The happiness, that joy was, you know, a few months at most. And normally the joy you get from swiping and having something new and shiny, but it completely wears off after some time.
Absolutely. And it was that realization for me that I was still paying off a credit card debt that I'd incurred a few years ago, 2 years ago, and I was still paying it off, and these clothes no longer fit me. That just made me realize, no man, this can't be life. This can't be it. This cannot be it. And actually now shifting. So now reading, realizing what I know now to say, you know, and I always say this, ideally, and this is coming from having been in the bank, ideally, you should have a credit card limit that you can pay off every 55 days.
Exactly.
You don't need to spend so much on your credit card that it takes you 2 years and you're paying the minimum to pay off this thing, because that's not what a credit card was meant for.
Yeah.
So for me, it's all of these things. Like, you know, personal finance has got so many facets and so many things that you do that interlink for you. And I'll go back to the financial wellness, for you to be financially well, because it's realizing that if I use a credit card for a big purchase, it's not meant for that. It's meant to be to cover a short-term need that I can pay off within 55 days. It's negotiating on a home loan. I shared this on Twitter in December last year. It's realizing that I can go back to the bank and negotiate the interest that I'm paying on a certain facility that I have, be it on a home loan is easier because the value of the home is increasing over time. So the bank usually is more understanding.
If you've been paying well also, that adds to that bigger picture.
Absolutely. So it's realizing, and I also realized that a lot of the people that were coming and asking to negotiate the rates were different races. Whereas we as young black females were just happy, excited that we got our home loan approved, that we didn't question, but what is this interest that you're charging me? Yes. What does this look like? Because ultimately that has a long-term impact on your finances. If you're paying a home loan that
is 3% above everybody else, or someone who was able to negotiate for a better interest, it does have a massive impact.
It does, especially for a 20 or 30 year bond that you have to pay over a period. That actually impacts your finances in ways you cannot even imagine. It's those little things for me that make me realize that we need to be talking about money more often. I always say, obviously it's not to, you need to gauge the situation, but I believe if we opened up a little bit more about people that we're comfortable with, you can't open up to everyone.
To everyone, of course.
People that you're comfortable with, to say, hey, what rate did you get on your home loan?
And I mean, it's just a rate, isn't it?
It's just a rate. To say, hey, what home? And then you realize, wait a minute, this person, when you actually talk to different people, you realize, wait a minute, what was so different about that rate and why can't I negotiate? But because we're so hush-hush about it, what we don't know, our lack of knowledge actually sets us back in so many ways that we can't even imagine, that I think we need to be talking about and not be hush-hush, because, you know, people thrive on not knowing. Your lack of knowledge actually costs you more.
The Bible does say so.
Absolutely.
Even the Bible does say so.
My people perish due to a lack of knowledge.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think for me, it's one of those books that holds so much knowledge, even with personal finance. But I want to find out from you as what is your proudest financial decision so far?
Sure. There have been quite a number.
I love that. I love that. There's been quite a few.
But I think my proudest is realizing that I can be financially well. I can take steps to bring myself to what I envision. So I can make my dreams a reality. So how I envisioned myself 5 years from now, it can become a reality. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes various steps. It takes hard work, obviously, and it takes you doing a mindset shift, but you can get there. And what I mean by that, I'll go back to financial freedom, is to say, you know, putting away a small amount of money can put me in a better financial position than I was 5 years ago. And I'm proud to say I'm in my late 30s now. Where I am, I could never have been there in the 20s. And it speaks to this instant gratification. I almost need to speak about it, because people look at my journey and other people's journey and think, hey, this person did it overnight. No, it didn't happen overnight. It took, I'm in my late 30s. It didn't happen. In my 20s, I was struggling.
My 20s were horrible. You're learning. You're receiving information and you're saying, this works for me. This doesn't work for me. This makes sense for me. Oh, no, I need to research more. And I think that really comes from, amongst other things, the peer pressure that we see, but also Instagram, that because you see the highlight, you think that is, you know, something that just happened overnight. But like you said, in your 20s, things were just a little bit all over the place, living from paycheck to paycheck, that sort of thing. But it took a mindset shift, number one, but also taking action to say, I don't need a massive salary. I don't need to start a whole business for me to, you know, become financially independent, become financially well. And you share your portfolio quite...
I do as much as I can for safety reasons as well, within the safety of confines, but I do. And I want people to be very practical, because what I've realized, what you spoke about, is inaction. So people hear all these things but don't do. And the not doing, over time, you're actually robbing yourself.
It compounds.
Your actions compound. You know, I always have this slogan, small habits, big rewards. It's this idea that you can do it over time and slowly. You can implement certain things. Someone, you're better off implementing now. You'll be better off in the next year, because you would have had a few months to build something. So a lot of the people that often that I'm so proud of is people that listen, read, do their own analysis and start. And they will start with 100 rand, they'll start with 200 rand, they'll start with 300 rand, but then they'll see the progress. And for me, it was like that, implementing my own investment journey. I started off with 500 rand because I was like, okay, you know what? I always want to test. It's that analytical side. Theory. Testing the theory. So whenever I hear different things, I test. I obviously do my own research. I do my own reading. I listen up. I personalize it to me and what it means for me if I were to implement it. And then I do it. So for me, the biggest victories, going back to that, has been doing. Has been reading about, for example.
The victory is in the doing. Right? So you share screenshots, obviously, of the things that you've invested in. Why do you particularly like shares?
So I do individual shares and I do exchange-traded funds. So I do like exchange-traded funds specifically because it's something I can invest in and do it on a monthly basis and not be worried about, this has happened here, this company has done this, this company has done that. I know that it's sort of more secure, and as long as I know why I've invested in, I can sleep well at night, unless something completely changes to throw it off. Then I'll maybe consider and say, is this thing still in line with where I'm trying to be and the goals, the financial goals that I have for myself? So it's almost doing that analysis and saying, okay, I will do individual shares that pay me dividends. So obviously, I always say it's a balance. So if you see me posting about dividend income from my shares, you must know that there's another piece of the portfolio that you don't see that actually balances then out this dividend income that gives
me
the income.
Do you withdraw your dividends or you reinvest?
I always reinvest. I don't need the money right now. I've set myself up in a way that I'm able to reinvest. It's obviously for the long term. So I do have a component of dividend, but I also have growth. So those that don't pay dividends, you obviously wouldn't see them because they're not giving me dividend income. But there's a whole, it's a holistic approach. So it's almost this holistic approach that says, and maybe I'll segue into the next part, is to say, how do I think about investing? I think about, one, I segment it. So I always think about cash. What is my immediate cash need? If something were to happen, if an emergency were to happen, I have what we always refer to as emergency fund. So I have that buffer.
Rainy day buffer
that I can run to. So that's my cash component. It's there. It's earning me interest. I'm not worried about the interest it's earning me, because that's money I'll need immediately. Then there's the other parts, and I always share this, bonds, which is obviously a higher interest from the cash, will earn me a higher interest than the cash. So there's a portion.
And do you do that through South African retail savings bonds?
I do that through the South African retail bonds, correct. So that's then that segment. And then I think of my own now discretionary portfolio, right, that you usually see me share about, that I manage myself, that I'm confident to play in, because it's my money and I think I'm confident enough. I am in the financial services sector, so I'm able
and
to
you
do...
study, you and do I your study. Own research, and you say, does this suit my goals? right? So that's the third portion.
And that's my discretion that I manage, and obviously have tax-free in there, tax-free investment account, because why not?
Absolutely.
The government allows you this, this
one
wonderful
of my favorite,
product.
Favorite types of investments.
Absolutely.
And if you can max it out every single year, mm-hmm. by all means do so. If mm-hmm. you have kids also, mm-hmm. actually maybe there's something that I want to ask you, right? Mm-hmm. So I have tax-free savings accounts for both of my kids.
Mm.
And you know the lifetime limit is 500,000, and people always say no, but then you're taking away their lifetime limit. And I'm mm-hmm. like, would you rather give someone 3 million versus wait for them to invest 500,000 on their behalf? Like, which one are you going
which
to take?
One
are, which one are you going? Like, that's not a that's a no brainer.
It's a no brainer. It's
it
a no brainer.
Absolute no brainer. Because you know, I was doing a presentation and someone asked that. I said, which one would you choose?
Yeah. No, so I at the moment I do the discretionary, and it's with a view that I'll also start putting for them in the tax rate.
Yes.
So I have the discretionary, but I will definitely, that's part of the plan. Mm. It's just that for me first, I always say this to parents, secure yourself first, because your kids still have way to live. And for me, I want to secure my financial so that I'm not bothering my kids about finances when they're grown up. I must secure myself. I'm also doing, still contribute, don't get me wrong, I still contribute towards investments for my kids, definitely. But then what I will do when I'm in a better position, I'll also start doing the tax-free as well for them. So whatever dividend income I might get from the non-tax, I will be transferring then to the tax-free. So it is in
the pipeline. That is such an important conversation that us as parents, we do not like to have, right? Because we want to do so much for them. Then we are not secure ourselves. Then what does that perpetuate? The black tax that we often even struggle to talk about. You know, that's why I think also, I think you were going to touch on that, saving and investing for your retirement, that your kids are not your retirement plan.
They're not your retirement plan. I never want to be in that position where I have to put my kids to be in a position to support me financially.
Yeah.
I think for me then, you know, ideally I should have done, something should have gone horribly wrong for it to ever happen to them. I think for me, kids should be allowed to be kids. They should be allowed to make their own mistakes.
Yeah.
They should be allowed to find themselves without needing to put the burden of them having to take care of me financially.
And especially, you know, stressing to the fact that, you know, obviously our parents did the best that they could with what they could, but we have so much more potential.
We do.
We have so much more potential, and it is in our decision making that will unlock that potential.
Absolutely. You know, I always share this. It's something, if you indulge me, I looked at the power of compounding.
Yeah.
And I shared this on Twitter, and I was crucified for it.
Twitter is Twitter.
But I shared this screenshot of, you know, when the child, your child is born, the first month they're born, when they get their birth certificate, how about opening up a brokerage account?
Yes.
And you can just, if you don't want to do all the research, put it in one exchange trade fund. A unit trust, whatever works for you, right? Put it in there every month, contribute 500 rand. And by the time your child is 18, there'll be something. By the time your child is 65, people say, but who will be around when they're 65? I'm like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
When they're 65, they'll have a huge lump sum. Yes, it won't be the same amount as what it is. The value won't be the same as today.
But that's why you invest.
But
so that you maintain the purchasing power.
Absolutely.
So, I find that there are conversations that are meant for other people and some are not, and that's okay, but keep on sharing what you're sharing. The ones who get it will get it, and the ones, maybe it will be years later, that's fine. But I find that, yeah, some platforms can be quite aggressive. And without people saying, hey, what does it mean? Even if it's not going to be 65 years. This person's talking about the number of years that you're going to allow your money to compound.
Mm.
So, I mean, with some platforms, like I say.
No, absolutely. You know, I got so much into our conversation, I forgot about the different parts
that we spoke about. Yeah, so it was obviously cash, it was bonds, it was your discretionary where, you know, it goes into either buying your shares and buying your exchange-traded fund, tax-free savings account.
And then pension.
And
the pension, retirement annuity, provident fund, it's that is managed by professionals.
Mm.
This, you put your money in there. Yes, you check twice a year, like I do.
Yes.
And make sure that it's performing. It's beating inflation. Because if it's not beating inflation, guess what? I will not be able to afford to retire. And that's a problem.
Mm.
So make sure that I always look at the statements. My pension fund statement, I look at what is it invested in. Is it growing or is it not growing?
Now, you are proactive in your own finances.
Proactive.
Yes.
You make the money. You work hard for your money. Your money should work hard for you. And that's my motto, right? If I'm working as hard, my money should be working equally as hard. And it's this thing of you need to make sure that your money is growing, that whatever. So I made the mistake, I'll share an example. So when I started working in 2008, 3 months later, I got into an RA on top of my pension.
Yes.
And 10 years later, 2018, I'm looking at this statement and I'm thinking, no, man, this money is not growing. It's obviously there was a 10% escalation every year. So I started off with an amount and 10% escalation for 10 years. And I looked at this and I went back and I'm like, no, man, why is this retirement annuity not growing?
Mm.
I then looked at the fees. I then looked at what I was invested in. When I took out that retirement annuity, I was 21. And yes, it's based on risk profile. I understand that. But it was in cash and bonds. Mm. And there was a small portion in equity.
That did not make sense for your age at all.
Why did this, you know, and financial advisor?
Yes, and also knowing the fact that, you know, for me, that's where sometimes I butt heads with certain individuals.
Mm.
That, yes, your risk profile might say, oh, you're a moderate person. Mm. But you, this is your retirement annuity, your pension.
Mm.
So meaning that you'll only be able to access this at the age of 55.
Mm.
What you should be doing is try to be as aggressive as possible in the beginning years, then closer if you are someone who is risk averse, to say, okay, let's change it down, let's tone it down to something that, and I see so many retirement annuities structured like that, and it makes my blood boil.
And there's a lot of people still in those structures, by the way.
Yeah.
People that just think, and people want to do the right thing financially.
Yeah.
I think for me,
please say that again.
People ideally want to do the right things financially. So people will have policies, people will have retirement annuities, people will have education policies, people will have all of these things, but rarely do they go back and say, is this still serving the purpose that I intended it to serve? And that's why I do an annual check-in with myself to say, okay, this is what I have. Is it still relevant? Is it not? Is it serving the purpose that it's meant to? Is it not? Am I paying fees, are the fees I'm paying correct? Is it not? Is it growing above inflation or is it not? And I do those checks because I don't want to find myself at the end of retirement or whatever it is and realize that I didn't do the right thing. I didn't, you know,
your intention was there. But I love the fact that you are saying you do that annual check-in, because what does that mean? It means that not only you're trying to do the right thing, but you're also educating yourself to know exactly, is this the right thing? Because how will you know it is the right thing or wrong thing if you don't educate yourself around personal finance?
I think I always say people spend so much time on wanting to make more money, but really look at the little things that they can be doing that will propel them further financially. Yeah. And it's those little things that I now always lament on this that help you. Knowing what products, knowing am I in the right product, knowing am I investing in, if you're doing an education policy, is it the right product for what I'm trying to do? Probably not.
Yeah, you don't want the fees also.
Because of the fees also. Mm. So it's always that check-in that is very important. Again, small habits, big rewards.
I love that. I'm going to use it somewhere. You don't mind me using that somewhere.
No, you can use it.
Small habits, big rewards. So for women, why do you think specifically, I mean, obviously financial freedom and financial wellness is for everyone and it should, you know, as it should be. But why is it specifically for women, you think, we really need to take care of ourselves.
Mm. So, you know, I'll start off by saying this. And I always refer to this, my grandma was not well educated.
Yeah.
But she was good with money.
Mm.
So she brought up 10 kids on selling vegetables and things.
Yeah.
My mom had a business that failed and still managed, and my parents, both my parents, and still managed to do things that an ordinary person who would have earned much more would have done.
Mm.
So sometimes it's about, you know, investing in your own knowledge. And as women are very good with money. I must tell you this. People always have this perception that, oh, women spend shopping and
shop.
They just want to shop. No. Women are good with money. I've been amazed because my mom has always been part of Stockfels. And I've been amazed at what some of the things those women have been able to achieve. And I've realized sometimes it wasn't, they just weren't given opportunities.
Yeah.
They just didn't know the right ways or mechanisms or tools to use to propel them, that they would have been further along than they are.
Absolutely.
So that perception for me, women are good with money.
Mm. Mm.
A woman can make 100 rand, 300 rand last till the month end. She will do whatever it takes to make that money last. So that for me is a non-starter. What I think we need to be doing is saying, these are the options. And that's why I love sharing what I share.
Yeah.
These are the options. Have you ever thought of, so most of the women I talk to will say, yeah, no, I'm saving my money. But don't know that, no, there's a difference between saving your money and investing. Mm-hmm. So saving, yes, will earn you that 6%. But hey, even as much as using a retail bond to earn you, I think right now, the 5-year fix is at 11.25. Just by shifting the kind of product you're using, you're moving from 6% to 11.25%. There is that option available. And yes, people will say retail bonds, we're giving money to the government, what if it falls, and doomsday. But still, it's a better product. Just by shifting the tool that you're using can propel you. So for me, it's about, how can we give women the tools, the right tools, to propel them to go forward in terms of their finances? Because they've already got the basis right. I think the statistics say, I think it was black women or more women are buying property.
Yeah,
I think two years ago.
Absolutely.
They're the most.
Then their counterparts.
Then
the
counterparts,
male.
Male counterparts. And I think there's another statistics that say South African households are headed up by single women. Black women, single black women that are doing it. So already they're there, but I think we just need to give them that opportunity. Already we're underpaid compared to our counterparts.
The gender pay gap.
So already the world is up against us. So we have to be twice as good with our money as anyone else.
That.
So let's just get the tools.
Yeah.
Let's give women the right tools. Let's share the knowledge. Let's talk about money freely so that women can demystify what they feel is this, you know, complex things that they need to know about fees, about EAC, about effective annual costs and all these things. Can we demystify it in such a way that women can feel they're in charge enough to start their own financial journey, so that if anything happens, and these days we talk about, you know, the divorce, there's a higher divorce rate.
Absolutely.
So that if you leave your partner, you'll be able to financially sustain yourself without this partner that might
not sustain
longer.
The lifestyle for yourself, and if you have kids as well.
If you have kids, to take care of your kids, to take care of yourself financially, that you're no longer dependent on another person, and staying, even if the circumstances are not favorable for you, because hey, financially,
I must stay because I still love you, not because I, outside of that, is I don't have any other option, you know. I also want to talk as a last point. We're not going to really get into it. You know, we've spoken about investments and emergency funds, and you've made that quite clear. I want us to touch on life cover and the importance of it in looking at your personal finances as a whole. I think especially because we as black people, I can't talk for other races, we are quite afraid of talking about using life cover as part of your legacy planning and generational wealth as a black people. You know, we were reviewing our policies and I said, should anything happen to us, will it be enough? number one. But also, even above that, and I know, thank goodness, this is not Twitter, because you get crucified for saying you want generational, deep generational wealth for your family, that it's not just about covering whatever expenses are there, but that this generation doesn't have to lift as hard. How is, what is your view on life cover? Yes, we can talk about the different other covers for you as an individual, you know, but how do you use that as part of your financial planning?
No, absolutely important, right? There's certain things, what is the saying? I don't know, I'll butcher it, but there's certain things in life that are definite, and one of them is death
and taxes.
And taxes, those things are whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, a life policy is a must, and it's a tool that I have one, because I've got financial dependence, and life cover is there for financial dependence. Is there someone that is financially dependent on you, on the salary that you earn? Do you feed them on a monthly basis? Do you send them a stipend on a monthly basis? Who are the people that are financially dependent on you? And how can you take care of them when you're no longer there to earn that income that you're earning? So I will share this. I got a life cover when I started working.
Yes.
And I thought, this life cover is enough, and I'm sitting there. And that's why I find it so important, because people crucify financial advisors and financial planners, but they are there for a reason, and they are important, because that's what they do.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I had my annual check-ins, as I usually do.
And that's what a good financial planner does as well.
Yes. They don't put you in a commission-based product, because that's totally something different, but they look at your overall thing and can charge your consultation fee and
I must say, as sorry to interject, but I have a financial planner, you know, even though I do this content and it's something that I studied for, me, I find that having a financial planner is someone who has an eye view of and they are not as emotionally connected to the things that you say you want. And sometimes he says, I know you want to do it this way, but what about this way?
And you need that. You need someone who can tell you that. So my one was like, and I used a work, because if you're part of a pension or provident fund, you do get a financial planner that's there for you. So I use the services of those guys, because, hey, most of the time it's free, because the fund administrator pays for them. So, and I've been a board trustee, so I know all about that. So then I was like, okay, we had a look, and he was like, listen, you took this out in 2008. We were in 2022, I think, at the time. And it's like, but your financial situation has changed drastically.
Yeah.
And you have not looked at this. Do you know that? And
so your focus was mostly on your investments, right?
My focus was mostly on my investments. I'm doing this. But then he was like, but you've got two kids now. Your financial circumstances have changed. You've got two kids that are, you know, this age. They're financially dependent on you. And you have other dependents that are depending on this. And looking at your what you have in terms of the things you own and all of that, since how it's grown over the few years, this cover, the life
is
cover amount you have
sufficient.
Is not sufficient anymore.
And yes, it has grown over the many years, but not to the extent that will meet your needs.
That will meet my needs.
Yeah.
And it's very important for you to check that. And I realized, oh, wait a minute, this was actually a blind spot for me.
Yeah.
Let me go back. And we actually now did the analysis, and then I upped my life cover amount. So for me, it's also that you also touched on the generational aspect, because if I have life cover, my kids don't have to be chucked out of the house. You know, you see these auction boards on the traffic lights that says insolvent estate. And it's the saddest thing, because for me, when I see that board when I'm driving, it basically says this person didn't plan post their death. They didn't leave enough. Now a wife, kids are finding themselves their house being auctioned to cover some of the things that I ordinarily life cover would have covered.
Yeah,
now
easily.
I know our and I hope I can say this, our and it's not or anything, our Indian counterparts are very keen on that. So they cover each other. I know a friend of mine, and I can say this because a friend of mine, actually in their family, they talk about life covers quite a bit, and the amount they cover themselves, so is enough when the person passes away, when they claim, it's enough for them to start something. It's enough, adequate for them to start that generational wealth that we're talking about, and they use it quite well. Now I know, like us, people, when you talk about death, people are like, what are you planning?
Yes.
planning to take me out, and it's not.
And you know, like I had a very similar conversation. Like I said, I was in Durban, and people said, no. But then, you know, once people know how much you have, then I said, guys, when are we gonna start trusting one another, as families, as a people, that, you know, this thing we are doing for the bigger picture.
Yeah.
It's a tool that is there, and other races and other people are using it and are using it well. Right? Mm. And for me, I looked at the life cover that we have between myself and my husband. I was actually proud that, goodness, should anything happen, I have loved my kids until even when I'm gone. And for me, that just makes me so proud.
It does. It does for me too as well. Because it says I love my kids enough to take care of them financially. I love my financial dependence because I have other financial dependents.
Yes, it's not just your kids.
It's just not my kids. I love them enough to take care of them even when I'm no longer there. Yes, they should be mourning my loss that I'm no longer here. Mm. But the one thing they should not be now fighting over is, how are we going to survive without this person?
Yeah,
what's the next two step? And I've seen it play out so much in so many communities, in our community specifically, where people, you know, their loved one is no longer there and people are now fighting for the little. It's not even a lot, but they're now fighting for the little that this person
had. You know?
Exactly, exactly.
And I just want to sort of wrap up with, you know, you see quite a lot of these things on social media, generational wealth, but are we actually using and utilizing the tools that are really right in front of us? You know, again, like you're saying, it's not just for your children, but you know, who else depends on you having a salary, having an income? You know, it might be your cousins, it might be... Then again, we are perpetuating black tax all over again. Because if you have life cover and you know that, okay, this family needs this much, you can do that allocation.
I'll speak on this. We need to be healing our traumas. And financial lack is a trauma.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it until I sat back and realized some of the decisions I was making was from a place of lack. And you never want to be making a decision, any financial decision, that starts from a place of lack, because ultimately anyone can come and sell you anything and you'll fall for it. And that's where you see you know, people buying into Ponzi schemes, because now it's from a place of desperation. And half of the time, those decisions, those Ponzi schemes, never work out because you're desperate. You're trying to make a quick buck here, trying to solve a problem, an immediate problem, and thinking this will be the way that I can do this, because you want to be, you know, making decisions from a healed place, a healed position. And I really believe personal finance has the behavior element. We cannot talk about personal finance in this rigid numbers type of format. We need to consider that personal finance comes with emotions.
Lots of emotions.
From trauma that we've experienced.
The backgrounds that we come from. All of that.
The decisions that we make, trying to, and you see it often, right? Trying to cover up with place of lack. Now I have access to money. Now I have access to credit. Let me fill the gap. And I was also guilty of it. I'm also guilty of it. I'm human. I make those mistakes as well. But it should be, okay, let me buy this because, you know, access to credit gives me the opportunity to buy this. And if I drive this car, then it will mean this is the perception I'll have. If I go home to the location, for example, and I'm perceived to be doing well. But ultimately, let's peel that back.
Yeah.
Are you doing it for yourself? Are you doing it because it's from a place of healing? Or are you doing it because you want to get recognition and acknowledgement from people that you've never been acknowledged before? But because they see what you have, the positions you have, now they acknowledge you. And the moment those things fall away, do you actually still have people's respect? Do you actually still have people's, you know, respect at the end of the day? And it's very important when we talk about personal finance to also talk about the behavior and the trauma that comes with it.
Yes, that was a whole TED Talk. Thank you so much for coming. One thing I really enjoyed about you are very practical. It's not just, you know, something that you're saying because, you know, now it seems like a popular thing, that you're quite sincere, that you're quite analytical, and thank you for taking action and showing other people that you can study a BSc and be good with money as well.
Thank you, and thank you for having me, and thank you for affirming me by having me on the show. Really means a lot. I've learned a lot from you as well. So really great to have had this conversation with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tribe.